This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. This show airs on Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast on your smartphone. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or Samsung or whatever you've got and search for DC 37 State of the Union. We're also, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can check out the website, www.dc37.net, and you can call the hotline to keep up on DC 37 events, 212-815-7555. If you have any comments on this or any other show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. Tonight, we are joined by City Council member Barry Grudenchik. He is a City Council member from Queens, represents the 23rd Council District in Eastern Queens. He is the chair of the City Council Parks Committee. Council member, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. How are you today?
I'm good. But we've got issues in terms of trying to, as the city budget process goes, winds its way through. Usually we have a budget by June, right? So that gives us
Yeah, we have to have a budget by June 30th. The last 2 years since I've been here, the budget's been early June. And that happens from time to time. I think there's a little more pushback from the city council this time around. So we'll see how close we get to June 30th this year.
And in your area, as the chair of the Parks Committee, we're talking about making sure that the parks are fully funded and making sure that there are people there to take care of the parks.
That's absolutely correct. There are 150 maintenance workers, gardeners, and such, whose jobs are on the line. They're District Council 37 members. I've had met with the heads of those locals a few weeks back. I've meet with Susan Chin, who is your representative here at City Hall all the time. And so we had a hearing the other day. I pressed the Parks Commissioner. I'm going to continue to press them. This is an issue of great concern to me and my colleagues, and certainly as the Parks Chair, it is my number one priority for restoration. This budget is $89 billion. The amount of money we're talking about here is just under $10 million, and certainly we will be able to find that, I believe. I certainly won't stop until we do find that money to make sure that these people are not laid off on June 30th. You have to remember something else. In the capital budget that's coming up over the next few years, we're going to be investing another $4.6 billion in parks. I believe that's about 6% of the total capital funding in the city. And we certainly don't want to invest these dollars and then have our parks become dirty and unusable. I can remember the bad old days growing up in my Pominock playground in the early 70s before there was a bottle bill, before we had enough money to have enough people clean the park. So we're not going back to those days.
The locals that are affected by this, Local 983, run by local president Joe Puglio, and Local 1505, the president of which is Dilsey Ben. Those are park ranger positions and gardeners and just park workers, correct?
Right, that's correct. Mostly the 150 jobs we're talking about are maintenance and gardeners. And those are critical. You know, you and I both grew up in Queens. When we were young, they didn't have as many flowers in the parks.
Right, right.
You know, we know that just the greenhouses and forest parks produce over 200,000 flowers a year. So people enjoy that. It's a nice thing to see. Our parks are doing well. We could always do better, but they've come a long way from the days where there would be burned out cars in parks and vandalism and graffiti everywhere. So I think we've made great strides. And it's these 150 workers, and certainly the two people that you mentioned are, you know, very serious about this, And I know they're going to do everything they can to protect their members.
How does these positions become, why are they in question?
That's a very good question. They really shouldn't be. And, you know, I've had this discussion with the administration, with others. It's the same with emergency food, which is, you know, the food pantry money. That is also a political football. These are very important things for our city. We certainly want to make sure that our parks are clean. And what's the point investing billions of dollars if you're going to leave them dirty? It's just, you know, they make such a difference. The gardeners and the maintenance workers make such a difference in making sure that our parks are usable. And if you go to our city parks, they are, you know, at this time of year, especially jam-packed.
And the New York Times did a special section a couple of weeks ago. I saw it in the print edition, and don't get often to see the print edition, but they did Summer in the City 1978, mm-hmm. and they did photos of parks mm-hmm. in 1978.
Yes.
And as you just discussed, the presence of automobiles where they shouldn't be and graffiti where it shouldn't be, the city has changed dramatically in the past 40 years in terms of the quality of the parks, and this is what we need to do. These folks are the people we need to help maintain them, right?
Right. I mean, there's no question. I don't know if you know Brookville Boulevard, where it snakes through Idlewild Park down there.
Sure.
As a much younger person driving to the Rockaways, you would see burned out car after burned out car. Would be common to see four or five cars, and it's hard to remove. I don't even know how they got them in there. It's crazy.
My father used to refer to that area jokingly as Shangri-La. And it certainly was anything but.
It was anything but. But now it's beautiful. The road still goes through there. You got to be careful at high tide. But we don't see that kind of thing. And a number of years back, I was walking through the Forever Wild section of Cunningham, and I guess I was off the beaten track a little. I stumbled on a chassis of an old car. I don't know how many years it had been there. So I called Parks. They went in. They couldn't find it. They asked me to come and show it to them. But it was rusted the color of leaves. It was like a reddish brown. And so, but they got it out of there. They took it right out, and they have, you know, a zero tolerance for that kind of thing, for graffiti. And that's what these workers are doing. And I think that if you ask the average New Yorker whether we need these workers, the response would be, of course, why? What are we even talking about here? So I think common sense will prevail, but I'm going to stay on top of them until it does.
And a question I ask every elected official who comes on this show, how did you get into how did you wind up in the city council as
that's a long
council?
That's going to have to be a whole show.
Well, okay. And at some point we'll do that. But give me the 2-minute version of what drew you to politics, especially
my father and mother were active. I think my father a little more so. He was a little league manager, that kind of thing. Was active in the needs of the community. There was great activism. I grew up in Pominock houses, and you know, in those days, you'd have 200 or 300 parents at a PTA meeting. A great hotbed of unionism, Lechester, the local 3 cooperative right across the street. So I had a lot of friends with that. I was always interested in, you know, just basically interested in what was going on in my community. Worked on some campaigns, and then in the fall of 87, I went to work for one of my mentors, Nettie Mayerson, who was an original cooperator in Lechester and is still living there. God bless her. And one thing led to another, and then I realized after a while I could do this. I could be an elected official, and it's all about persistence. It's all about, you know, staying on focus and having good staff also, because you get dragged into, you know, 100 different directions each and every day, and people want to see you, and your time is, you know, your most valuable commodity at the end of it all. But I think, you know, most of the people that I work with certainly, they care a great deal about their communities. They just want to help people, and that's what drew me to it. And Nettie told me very early on, she says, you're not going to get rich being an accountant, you know, in working in government, but the feeling you get from helping people is priceless, and that's true. And so that's what we do. That's the most important thing.
And what's your state of the – do you think politics is so big today? I mean –
government is huge. I mean, it's tremendous. It's everywhere.
And the people that you come in contact with, your constituents, what are they concerned about right now?
I think most of the things that we hear about are quality of life issues. I think people are concerned about what's going on in the Middle East or, you know, the relations with China at some level. But my, you know, the old saying is all politics are local. And I think people care mostly what they can see from their front window.
Right.
So, you know, if a car parks in front of the house, that's right. You know, that kind of stuff. It's almost always innocent stuff. You know, crime in my neighborhood is thank God it's low, and it's much lower than it was when you and I were growing up in New York City. So that's something that people are on. They're also, education is critical. We want to be able to educate our young people. I know whenever I visit a school, I always go to see the workers in the lunchroom. Those are DC 37 people.
Right.
You know, that's what matters, I think, to people. People are worried about public safety and education of their children. And if you don't have kids in school, it's still important because, you know, if you're a homeowner or a co-op owner or a condo owner, the value of your investment is directly tied to the value of the education that the young people are receiving. So those are things that we work on constantly. I'm in every school every year. I visit every single school in my district. That's 32 of them.
Well, we're talking with City Council Member Barry Gradenchik. He represents the 23rd Council District in Eastern Queens. He is the chair of the City Council Parks Committee, and we're going to be pushing to make sure that the cities have all the parks workers and all the DC 37 members to keep the parks beautiful and well maintained. Thank you very much, Council
Thank
Member.
Thank you, Chris. And full disclosure, my mother, God rest her soul, was also a DC 37 member. She was a member of Local 2054.
Great. Great.
All right.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Have a great one.
All right. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748, 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. We're welcoming back to our show an old friend, investigative journalist in residence at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, Tom Robbins. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Chris.
You wrote a piece recently in the New York Daily News about the Giuliani-Trump political legal partnership with regard to the Stormy Daniels issue and other legal challenges confronting Trump. I wanted to talk to you about the history of these guys, because as you pointed out in your piece, you know, these are the two New Yorkers who are sucking up all the oxygen in terms of media and in terms of the attention. These are the two guys. I remember when I lived in Los Angeles, and people would always say, Los Angeles doesn't have the culture of New York City. How could you be in Los Angeles? And I'd be driving on the highway, and there would be Howard Stern on the radio. And I would think to myself, of all the things that had to come from New York to Los Angeles, why Howard Stern? You know? It couldn't be listening to the New York Philharmonic or something. And in a way, these guys are the Howard Stern of politics.
That's not bad, except Howard Stern actually had a sense of humor.
Right.
and made us laugh. I don't get the joke here, if it's a joke. I really don't. I mean, deep blew New York City, known for its incredible creativity, its incredible tolerance, its wellspring of original characters. These are the two people that we put on the national stage to represent our city.
And they kind of took it. Well, let's talk about Trump first, because during the campaign, New Yorkers did try to tell the world what we knew about Donald Trump. And it wasn't so much about political ideology. It was more about there is no there, right?
You know, I think we were, kind of like shouting into a gale because
right.
of the fact that there was so much going on in the Trump organization all across the country at that point. But, one of the things that stays with me was a column by a very conservative writer in Cranes who would cover the real estate beat, who basically wrote that I talked to all of the people involved who do big real estate deals in New York, the big developers, the big landlords, and to a person, they all agree that this is the worst person they've ever done business with. And, this was not a poll of the journalists. This is not a poll of the politicians. These are the make money people.
Right.
So, that was something which I think people tried to say that, like, look, if you're looking for someone who just can't get his story straight ever and you want him in the Oval Office, this is your guy because he's made a career out of it. It didn't get heard.
And Rudy Giuliani, though, is a different story because Trump got a lot of headlines. I mean, you got to always give him the fact that in New York City, Trump always got a lot of headlines. Rudy Giuliani actually had a great deal of respect in certain circles and by certain journalists for his crusading prosecutions and his work as a prosecutor.
One of the things I tried to sketch out very quickly in that Daily News column was the fact that two of my closest friends and late colleagues, Jack Newfield and Wayne Barrett, were probably two of the greatest promoters of Rudy Giuliani's career when he was the United States attorney in Manhattan in the 1980s, and he tilted his lance at municipal corruption. And Jack and Wayne had been writing about that for years with nobody, at least nobody with subpoena power, listening very closely. And all of a sudden, here came Rudy Giuliani, and he laced the land with subpoenas, and he indicted most of the big players, won convictions. And Jack and Wayne were both very enamored of him. They wrote a wonderful book called City for Sale, which really tells the story of that era. And then Rudy got elected mayor, and they both changed their minds very dramatically once he was in office.
And what was it? But how had Rudy changed? I mean, how had Rudy changed between being the prosecutor and being the mayor in their eyes or in journalists' eyes?
Well, I think it changed for both of them in different ways. But a man whose approach to a problem is a subpoena and an indictment is not necessarily the best person to run a city as diverse and complicated and just everyday crisis-ridden as New York is. And Rudy showed that to us almost from day one, where he just went charging headstrong, shouting down everyone from EMTs who were trying to take somebody to a certain hospital. Then he started screaming, take them to this other hospital. I mean, he put on some pretty consternating displays. But I think the issue that really got us, and I include myself in it, was race. Giuliani had succeeded David Dinkins, the first black mayor of New York, and he had won very narrowly against Dinkins. So you would think that he would have had some outreach to the black community to say, okay, I know I wasn't your pick, but here's what I'm going to do. And instead, he started almost immediately lecturing the black community about, well, here's the proper way, if you have a problem with me, to present your grievance. And it was just one incident after another of him basically being so tin-eared to the problems of minorities that you just began to realize this guy just doesn't get it in terms of how people who are maybe poor, maybe black, maybe Hispanic operate in this city. And you could tell it from City Hall. He had, I think, the whitest City Hall in years in terms of his top aides, and they didn't seem to care. There was this one really telling memo that the Daily News got a hold of in the first term by one of his top aides that said, don't worry, three white guys have been running this city for a generation.
The Dyson memo.
Yeah, and they thought that was fine. So race was really the dividing line more than anything else.
And it never got better in terms of race. I mean, you mentioned in the column, you didn't mention the person's name, but you mentioned that, I'm just going to read from
Patrick
the column.
Dorisman.
Right. And you said, when a 26-year-old black man was shot to death by an undercover detective on a midtown street, the mayor justified the shooting by putting the victim's long-sealed juvenile records before the public. Now, Patrick Dorisman, if I remember correctly, was actually killed while he was refusing a drug deal. I mean, this is the most outrageous story.
Exactly right.
This was a guy who didn't want drugs, and there were undercover police officers trying to sell him drugs, and Patrick Dorisman wound up dead.
Not only that, Chris, he was wearing the uniform of the private security service for the 34th Street bid. You know, he was a private law enforcement officer at the time that they went up there. And then Rudy Giuliani not only insisted that his officers had done the right thing, he insisted that they knew that Dorisman was a bad guy. And here's his sealed juvenile record to prove it. A juvenile record that was made up almost entirely of arrests and which had been sealed. And Giuliani said, well, since he's no longer alive, he's not entitled to privacy anymore. That was a stunner.
So good prosecutors don't necessarily make good mayors. And Rudy was also, though, what I also remember about Rudy Giuliani was
apparently they don't make good governors and good attorney generals.
Well, that's a whole other issue. We're not going to go there right at this moment. But Giuliani also, I remember, and I remember quite clearly one day asking Rudy Giuliani, we were talking about Colin Powell, and there was some speculation that he would run for president. And Rudy initially didn't want to talk about it. But then I asked him if Colin Powell ran for president, should he run as a Republican? And Rudy went into this long riff on how, yes, there was such a great need for moderate Republicans and for moderate voices in the Republican Party. And he seems to have ignored his own counsel. It doesn't take he moves with political winds, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, he jumped on Trump's bandwagon. And look, I mean, he changed his position on so many things. I mean, one of the most telling episodes in Wayne Barrett's follow-up book, the one he wrote basically to apologize for City for Sale and making him a hero, called Rudy, he had long interviews with the other Rudy, Rudy Crewe, who had been schools chancellor under Giuliani, and the two men were thick as thieves. They would go smoke cigars together. They were good buddies. And then Rudy decided all of a sudden he was in favor of school vouchers, something that would essentially rob the city school system of a good deal of its funding. And Rudy Crewe said, well, wait a minute, you didn't tell me that. And the second Rudy Crewe disagreed with him in public, Giuliani basically cut him off. And the quotes from Rudy Crewe to Wayne Barrett after he had left City Hall are astonishing in the way he describes Rudy Giuliani cutting him off as his friend and just coming after him. He said something along the lines of, I've studied animal behavior. And this man's behavior makes them look very good.
I remember when Giuliani was getting rid of Bratton, and I remember, and you know, and the cops are big boys and they know how to play rough. And I remember Bratton and John Miller talking about you don't know the lows to which these guys will go, meaning the guys in City Hall. I mean, Giuliani was, and then of course there is, to give the man his due, there were those incredible weeks after the fall of the towers.
There was a moment, no question. There was a real moment in which he expressed everyone's fears and hopes. I will never forget him answering the question at the makeshift news conference after the collapse when people tried to press him about the number of dead. And Rudy said, whatever it is, it's more than we can bear.
Absolutely. I remember that. Yes,
indeed.
And
it was such a, you know, so it sort of grabbed you and you said, yeah, you know, this is it. Maybe this guy. And look, I think he did a great job of holding us together in an incredibly frightened moment in the city. And that was leadership. You know, he later wrote a book called Leadership, and he stuck too many of his chapters in it. But that was an episode which truly did show a need for a great leader. You know, unfortunately, you know, one of the issues became the fact that Giuliani had insisted on placing the city's emergency services place right next to the World Trade Center, which had already been bombed, and that building went down too. I mean, there were a number of things that he hadn't done such great examples of leadership for that he never owned up to.
And there was something mercenary about the way he then tried to capitalize on those terrible weeks and his role during those terrible weeks. Because,
yeah, you know, he was America's mayor and he was looking to sell that. I'm not sure I necessarily blame him for that. If you're going into private life, which he was forced to do because, you know, he dropped out of the Senate race and he really tried to run for president on that. You know, that's it's his strongest claim to fame. And even today I saw he got back in this thing with Joe Scarborough, and Scarborough started saying all these things about how he should change his name to Rusty Giuliani because he's just not up to it anymore. And Giuliani comes and say, well, hey, you know what? You never had to deal with 9/11. You never had to deal with it. And that's true. That's unquestionably true. What it tells us about him now, however, doesn't seem to be very much, because his behavior as Trump's lawyer and spokesman has been so zany. That's the only word you can use, just erratic and zany, to the extent that it now appears that Trump, as he is wont to do with most people that he hires, to just shunt him aside because he's not helping.
Question about, before we go, a question about where history will judge two different mayors, David Dinkins and Rudy Giuliani. What are your thoughts?
I think that, you know, David Dinkins is still due a good deal of reconsideration about what happened. He was a one-term mayor. What he might have been in the second term, we'll never know. But, you know, there were things that changed in the way that New York City operated, and including trying to get a handle on crime, something that, you know, that Giuliani would never acknowledge, but that the numbers began to fall after Dinkins won the funding from the state legislature with Peter Vallone, the head of the city council, to put more cops on the streets. He started changing the way in which education was provided in city communities. He changed the way that health care was provided. There were just a lot of ways in which David Dinkins was trying to make this city, as he used to call it, the Great Mosaic, and pay attention to people, that sort of got washed out in the Giuliani avalanche that came after him.
And also the way he has handled his post-mayoralty versus the way Giuliani's handled his post-mayoralty, that's a contrast in styles, isn't it?
Yeah, they're dramatically different people. I'm not sure David Dinkins was looking to be a player on the political scene as Giuliani was. But, David Dinkins is still out there to this day, kind of a solid citizen representing the best of New York. Every time there's an issue where you want to go and ask somebody, what do you think? David Dinkins is there.
Tom Robbins is investigative journalist in residence at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, and he manages the school's Urban Reporting Grants Program. His series on violence in New York prisons, produced in collaboration with the Marshall Project and the New York Times, was named a 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist for investigative reporting and won the 2016 Hillman Prize for newspaper journalism. Mr. Robbins, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show and to share your insights. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
Okay. That's just about all the time we have on the show for this week. Before we go, a couple of announcements. We are having town halls. Henry Garrido, the executive director of DC 37, is holding town halls throughout the month of May. If you want to come and listen to the future of the union and what the issues are facing working New Yorkers who are working city employees, please give us a call at 212-815-1095 for a schedule, or you can check the DC 37 website at www.dc37.net. All right. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next week, ciao.